Twas Lions Church, number 18, we think. Actually, Steve checked that for me because I really had no idea. And someone probably corrected me, but podcast number 18, we're glad you could join us. I don't know what your week or weekend looked like, but I could have just actually listened to that intro for a while and rocked out to that. That would have been good. But we're glad you could join us. A shout out to all those who listen to us and sometimes who tell us that they listen to us. It's nice to know that there's real people listening to our podcast. And
with faces.
With faces and
ears.
So.
Ears.
Oh, no.
Better if they're listening. Yeah.
So thank you. Thanks for the shout outs to tell us. Thank you for people who send in questions. Maybe you listen to us every week and you think of questions, but you think, nah, I won't send that in. You should send it in. You should do that.
And if you're nervous, make up a fake email address and send it from there. Then
we
don't know who it is.
In our new segment, Stump Tyler.
Stump Tyler, yeah. Maybe that would be a great podcast.
That segment will last 1 week, and I'll be proved stumpable, and then we'll move on.
Well, it could be entertaining, though.
Yeah. But it'd be fun. Unless it's about sports. That'd be a hard time. That's not something I want to brag about, though. Anyway.
Okay.
Rhoda, sorry.
Moving on. Time change this last weekend. Guys, how do you feel about time change?
It's the worst.
You don't even have children.
No, but I have a bed and a sleeping pattern and a deep-seated hate for daylight savings time.
Do you?
Yeah, I really hate it.
Though I am loving, like, I love Sunday when...
when you get an extra hour?
It was like, I'm eating dinner and it's like still light out but during dinner conversation. Yeah, that was nice.
That's what people always say as the benefit. If we didn't change the clocks ever, it would still be like that. Daylight savings time is, I understand.
We just ended daylight savings, right?
Yeah.
We didn't start daylight savings.
Yeah,
we're back onto normal time.
Yeah. So it gives us, in the periods between, October, wherever, or November, and March, when it happens, it gives us an extra hour.
Of morning. I don't need morning.
I don't need morning. I don't want to drive home in the dark at 4 in the afternoon. That's the part of daylight saving time. It's just like... It tears
all,
at me and
all the people
kills
that are
me a little bit every day.
All the people that are up at 8 a.m. going for a walk and want sunlight.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, like, you don't need.
I'm not too worried about your kid waiting for the bus in the dark. I don't want to drive home in the dark. That was what I was
told
in
Tuas. That is not our youth pastor. We're talking.
None of these kids take the bus in Tuas. I'm kidding about that, but like in the sense of the idea is to have more morning time, and that was what. And
I'm not a morning person either, so I can't vote for it. Either.
I'm not even really that familiar with what the morning is. I'm just learning
it's
now.
Before you eat lunch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we had daylight saving time on Sunday, but Friday we had Encounter. It was a good. There's a huge portion of our staff team who's responsible for working on Encounter, and it's not one of the things on my list, but I went to it, and I just want to say I really appreciate it, guys. And I'm saying that as a parishioner.
I didn't have any.
It was one of the flock.
You spoke at it.
But I mean in the sense of this planning way. And like...
Right. No, Paul.
The band was great.
Paul puts it together.
The band was great, and you didn't share it either, Steve. Like, we had three people.
I kind of designed it
The themes were great.
I love Encounters. I love when we get people in the congregation getting up and doing reflections on things and then spending time praying and worshiping together, and it just feels like such a different context than Sundays. It's just about meeting and worshiping and thanking God and bringing stuff before Him, and it's good.
I like hearing from different people. Like Bob, I thought was excellent what he shared. Whitney, Tyler, you were adequate, and
you were above.
But like every time we have three people, usually it's not me and Paul. Often it's people we haven't heard from before, and it's I'm actually the only thing I'm ever surprised by is how there's not like 200 people at Encounter because it's so awesome.
I know there's different factors in there. We did offer it with childcare before, but it
people weren't coming.
Weren't bringing their kids to it, and so we wanted the people who were providing childcare, if they're not looking after kids, to be able to participate. But they have, like, honestly, for the people that have gone, and what I've heard back is there aren't, January is pretty good. We had a decent number of people out, of people around. There's a bunch of people away right now. But I only ever hear from people who go and engage with it and go there, the positive stuff about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? So I just want to encourage you, if you're listening and you haven't come to an Encounter, come out. It is, I know sometimes it's like, oh, I'm going to, I worship and pray. And there's always tons of reasons. All I'm saying is you should come. You'll be glad you did.
It's like a lot of things, I think, where church related things where it's like, yeah, that day you're like, oh, you know, I've got other things on, or it'd be nice to just have a quiet night. So you're tempted to not participate. Sometimes like your community group, you're like, it'd be nice if I wasn't doing it tonight. But then you go and you're always like, I don't regret. I'm so glad I did. Mm-hmm. I almost didn't, but I'm so glad I did. Like the nights when I wish I didn't have community group, but then I benefit from it. It's so encouraging or whatever. It's like that too, I think, where it's like, oh, it's one more thing. We could just have a quiet night. But then you're like, never regret it after.
I get it for like, because it's not like, some people I know actually enjoy exercise. So just, if you are one of those people, pretend you're not for a moment. Pretend you're weird. Tender me and just go like, no, I don't enjoy it, but I know I need to do it. I know it's good for me and I'm glad if I've done it, but I don't enjoy it. But like Encounter for me on Friday, I mean, I was looking forward to it, but then it was a crazy week. Friday was crazy. It got to dinner time. And to be honest, the last thing I wanted to do, I didn't even feel like in the right place or mind frame to like go and meet with God. But then I kind of all knew all the more that that's why I should go, and I didn't regret it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in the same boat. Like it was a Friday was a day off, and just kind of those days off do fills up, and I was just like said to my wife, I'm on the drive up, like, oh, could really take a pass on tonight. And then on the way back, we both looked at each other like, wow, I'm really glad we came. Like it was good. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't good in the sense of like we went home feeling like emotionally charged. It was more like we enjoyed like worshiping in community with the people that were there and thinking about the themes of like repentance and forgiveness and adoption and how like it was just these simple truths that we talk about all the time, but actually to kind of spend some time thinking and praying through with people we are growing committed to and care about was really good. Yeah, if you haven't been,
and it wasn't even, it's not even that it's like super fancy. You're not going, you go and you go, wow, that was a great night because it was so well produced. Though it is
the music
well
put together.
But it's just because it is what it is. You've actually, it's not the same rhythm as a Sunday morning. You're going there and you're going to hear and reflect and worship, and it's about reflecting on God. And no matter what your day, like I went from like a crazy day in a week to coming out of there more focused on truth and who God's character is, and then everything else kind of just shifts into perspective. It was just, it was good. Okay. So thanks. I just want to say thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Get a little PR out there from someone who didn't put it on and say, hey, come check it out next time. Anyway, so moving on, you know what? Today, we're going to focus on questions. We're going to focus on what we've just been talking about. Listeners giving us questions. We love that. And there's one that we were sent a while ago, and we promised to do it. And so we're going to get to it today, along with some others. And I'm just going to go right into that. And it is, there's two questions. One is, how do we know, and this is from someone who attends our church and are dealing with other people asking them, maybe non-church people outside of that context that are in their lives, and not knowing how to explain to them, like, how do we know there is a God and there is a Jesus? So, Steve, maybe you could help this person know maybe best how to field these kind of questions.
Those are actually really different questions. How do we know there's a God? And how do we know about Christ? I mean, we can focus on
that. We must start with Jesus first, because that's probably the easier one to answer, and then go backwards. But
so some people will say, you know, like, do we know that Jesus really lived, really died, and really rose again? This is actually a pretty easy question in some ways, because there's zero question historically that there was a real man named Jesus Nazareth who really lived a remarkable life, miracles, things of that nature, who really died on a Roman cross and rose again. And I can actually prove that to you from history without even quoting a Christian source. Mm-hmm. Just from secular Greek history and Roman history, Jewish history, without even quoting a Christian, it's a historical fact that a man named Jesus lived, died, and rose again, and that thousands of people immediately followed and worshipped him as a god. That's just from the secular Romans and stuff like that. So guys like Suetonius and Tacitus and Pliny the Younger, these are Roman historians who talk about it, and Josephus, the Jewish historian.
That was the one I knew when I tried to throw it in there. And I was like, I got Josephus. He hasn't said it yet. Dang it. That was my contribution to the question.
would they also say that he rose again? Would they actually say that? Or would they say his body was missing?
Well, there was witness. Like, they would talk about witness accounts of people. And Steve will fill in the blanks here, obviously, because I'm just jumping in on him. But, like, witness, eyewitness testimony of a lot of people seeing him.
So here's the direct quote from Josephus, who was not a Christian, but was a first century historian. He didn't believe in Christ. This is what he said. Now there is about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct at this day.
So, which I knew, the existence of the person of Jesus Christ is not in dispute historically.
No.
And what I find interesting is I had a conversation with an unbelieving, non-church-going friend who said, oh, I believe in God, and we were talking about the person of Jesus, and we agreed that you can't deny that Jesus existed.
Mm-hmm.
But then we were talking about the fact, I'm like, but a lot of people, like, want to like Jesus. Nobody wants to say he was a bad guy. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to say he was a good guy, and he did great things. Nobody wants to, like, badmouth the person of Jesus. They just want to question in who he really was, well, like a savior. But I'm like, but in this conversation, I'm like, but you, it's like Josh McDowell, other people say, like, you can't do that. Like, if you look at the claims of Jesus Christ, either he was who he said he was, or like C.S. Lewis, Josh McDowell, or he was crazy lunatic because...
Well, he was a liar, yeah. Like,
yeah,
C.S. Lewis, I think, put it as best as he could. You have to, there's really three ways to go with Jesus. He was Lord, he was a lunatic, or he was a liar. And that if he was a lunatic, worthy to be discredited. If he was a liar, worthy to be discredited.
Yeah.
But if we won't surmise that he was a lunatic or a liar, then we actually have to confess that he is Lord, and therefore we can't be passive about his lordship because of the things he claimed. So it's
just crazy if you think of how many people actually claim he's are still passive about lordship.
Yeah, but you know what?
That's a whole other topic.
I think so many people. I think part of it is so many people voice things that they don't know in the sense of, like, they want to sound learned and they want to sound like they've thought these things through. But I think a lot of people haven't actually given careful consideration and actually looked at a lot of evidence in general. And I'd say, like, a couple months ago I was working at a sporting goods store and I made a comment about something and this guy replied by saying, I made a comment like, oh, I heard the Oilers are going to make a move about trade so-and-so. And he said, yeah. And there's also rumors that Jesus Christ was a real person, is how he responded to me.
Oh, wow.
And meaning, like, that's not going to happen. And we got into a discussion.
Did he know that you were a pastor at the time?
I think so. Oh. I think he was kind of trying to pick at me. And we got into a discussion, and I said, like, look, man, like, you can't deny that Jesus walked the earth. And he said, yeah, I can. Watch me. I'm denying it.
But that's and just ignorant.
And I just said,
oh,
like, but
crazy.
You're actually doing it from a place of ignorance. And I can look at you and say, like, you're an idiot. No offense. But, like, you haven't thought it through. You haven't looked at any evidence. Mm-hmm. So you're actually, by saying, I'm going to just willfully ignore everything and just choose that, because I think often it's because people don't want to admit that if A equals B or whatever, like, if they do that math in their head of what it means, what it's going to cost them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So much of it's evaluation of that.
Yeah.
Was Alexander the Great a real person? Did he exist? no sane person would question this. He clearly, he was a young man, conquered the world by the age of 30, died young. We know a lot about Alexander the Great, and nobody would question whether he really ever existed. But the earliest, like there's little historical references here, but the earliest like biography, a treatment of any length on his life, wasn't written until 350 years after his death. And the earliest copy of that source we have is another 700 years older. Like, and yet nobody would question that Alexander really lived. Mm. And yet we have eyewitnesses to Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. Mm. Like the Apostle Paul, for instance, wrote 1 Corinthians in about the year 55. He talks about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Like you think 1 Corinthians 15, this is the gospel. He lived, he died, was buried, rose again, appeared to eyewitnesses, and lists off all the eyewitnesses. He writes that in the year 55, just 25 years after the resurrection of Jesus, quoting sources who were there, people who are still alive. Mm-hmm. He talks about 500 eyewitnesses, many of whom are still alive today, he says, which is almost like this, look them up. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah,
they're still alive. Plus, you can ask them yourself.
Plus, you have the Roman accounts that aren't even from Christian. They're not even.
Yeah,
you can't claim. Oh, they're just a certain group of people trying to make a story up.
Well, and the Apostle Paul was a dedicated skeptic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
opponent. I think of James, Jesus' half brother, who was committed publicly against Jesus. Like, he did not believe in Jesus. Jesus was his brother, but he was losing his mind.
So obviously he believed that Jesus was real.
So you had
not necessarily.
You had his followers like Peter and John. You have James and Paul, guys like that who start out against meet the risen Christ, change their views 180. Yeah. And so we have all kinds of eyewitness accounts, and then there's the Gospels, which are written in like the 60s, 70s, John probably closer to 90. Eyewitness accounts dating back to the first century, then the copies we have of these date back within years. Like, it just does not compare to anything else in history that we would take for historical
and
fact.
And historical scholars, not the guy at the sports store, but like historical scholars.
People
who
with
are
an
not,
education.
Who not are the, not, but like, yeah. who are not even Christians. So they're not even like on the Christian camp. They would not refute.
But I think.
So Bart Ehrman, who's the most well-known skeptic opponent, he calls himself agnostic, leaning towards atheistic. He's written books like Misquoting Jesus. He's a brilliant man. He's dead wrong on a number of issues. But he would say that Jesus really lived, really died, and I think he would even admit that Jesus rose again. Hmm. Because you can't deny it. It's historic fact. What he questions is the reliability of the manuscripts. But this is where he utterly goes off the rails. He's a former evangelical who has totally abandoned his views and his faith. And his commitment to these, his now agnostic view, leads him to misread the evidence. But even him, well-known, mm-hmm. written many books, doesn't question for a second that Jesus lived and died on a cross. Like, there's no question.
Which is when you come back to the point of C.S. Lewis, though, right? Like, I'm just bring it back to the point of the question. Like, if you're talking with someone, then you get two counts. People who say, oh, they're totally ignorant of any historical fact, and they're like, he never existed. Uh-huh. Then you get people like, we existed, but I don't necessarily believe he's the son of God or myself. Like, and that's where we get back to the C.S. Lewis quote, which is either a liar, a lunatic, or the truth. But I think the fact is that a lot of the people who think that don't actually know what he said, and that's a challenge, is to go back and see what Jesus said about himself.
Well, I think I would just say, like, I think one of the best ways to kind of answer these kind of questions is to acknowledge the fact that believing that Jesus was who he said he was takes faith. It all, because we don't have a photograph, we don't have video evidence of him walking on water. Jesus, chances are, hasn't spoken to you audibly. You haven't seen him in the flesh. However, what we can say about the fact, the historical Jesus and the Jesus who was who he said he was and is who he says he is, that it is a completely reasonable faith
yes.
to come to that Jesus was who he said he was. and it's actually more reasonable than the alternative that he didn't exist, that he was some part of mythology. It's actually unreasonable faith. It doesn't equate, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. And there's, 2,000 plus years of history that would slap you in the face from that position to say, mm-hmm. no, all signs point towards here. So, we don't have eyewitness testimony anymore because it's been 2,000 years. Everyone's dead. Mm-hmm. But
eyewitnesses wrote it down.
Boom. Yeah.
Which is great historical evidence.
Yeah.
So it's faith.
It's but completely it's faith reasonable.
That, it's faith that fits with the facts
yes.
of evidence.
Which leads into our next question.
We're going to talk about God.
About how do you know there's a God? Because you also think, you brought up the question of faith, right? It's like it's a reasonable faith. And one thing that often strikes me is when people say, oh, well, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in anything. I'm like, you can never not believe in anything. If you're choosing not to believe in the existence of God,
that's a faith system.
That is actually still a faith system because you have to believe that there's something.
Which is often what makes atheists so,
angry?
Hypocritical is that atheists will define themselves as being absent of a God belief. Not that they don't believe in God. That they don't believe, they lack a God belief. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
Which is a faith system in itself. Yes.
You're putting your faith in that there's nothing, right? So that's one of the things that gets me is you can't say you don't believe in anything because it's not possible to believe in nothing.
Or when people say I believe in science,
so does God.
Hypothetical as if you want to make that argument, if not more so than Christian faith.
Well, and I know this is a cheesy example, and I can't remember. It's probably a famous quote because I've heard it somewhere before. But it was talking about someone's talking to, and they're like, "Oh, well, you have, all this faith in this God. How do you know it's real?" And they're like, "But you believe they believed in evolution." He's like, "So you believe we emerged out of a puddle somewhere? That's actually." A lot of faith that actually would happen, right? Like your belief system actually feels a little crazier to me than mine, kind of thing. So,
there's a number of ways you can look though. For there's no, I can't give you an airtight argument to show you God. I mean, God's not scientifically provable like it is like a math equation or like he's in this box and here he is and there's no doubt and it's a repeatable experiment. Like you can't science can't prove lots of things. Science can't prove that truth exists or that. Science can't prove love. There's all sorts of things that science can't prove or that are, you can't prove in a court. But there's lots of clues for God. There's things that we could look at which we would say God is the best explanation for this. So and apologists, guys in the apologetics field or would look at all sorts of arguments. So there's things like the fine-tuning of the universe. So we'd say, you look at the conditions that are required for life on Earth to exist, things like if the moon were any closer, the tides of the Earth would be so strong that every day all land would be covered. And then, things like that. If the gravitational pull would make life, the moon was any closer or further, life wouldn't be sustainable because the gravity would kill us, crush us, or we'd float into space, or the temperature because of the distance to the sun. There's all sorts of, there's actually about
things
a dozen.
Things are all holding everything in
there's
place.
There's about a dozen of these things that are very, very, within 1%, or less than that, if it were any different, just 1% hotter, cold, life would not be sustainable. And there's enough of these things lined up that if one of them weren't true, life couldn't exist. And you go,
A lot of controlled chaos.
You end up end up with going, there is 10 billion universes and we're just the lucky ones that all the things lined up. Or you go, there's a designer. Which is a better explanation?
Yeah. Well, and I think that it's almost, it gets more ridiculous in a sense the closer you get to humanity. Like when you start with the universe, you talk about all the things that you talk about. For me, when you think about what it takes for conception to happen, the miracle of timing and all the icky stuff that goes on. But then not only that, but for conception to happen and then a child to be born,
chromosomes,
and the chromosomes develop and the DNA develops and how it's distinguishable and like these little things, or like how the human body orchestrates itself to fight disease and digest food and like live. Like, I don't, like, to me, I'm just like, yeah, we, this all happened out of a blob of cells. And it's just, oh, we're lucky. Thank our lucky stars, because that's all you have to thank, that it worked out this way. And I just kind of go, like, you know what, that's not enough. And then for me, the biggest thing that I've landed with is that I'm not satisfied that we are the end of knowledge. There are so many things as human beings we cannot and will not know. It's impossible for us to know. That I cannot believe we are the most intelligent beings in the universe. That there has to be someone far greater than us. Because at the end of the day, like, it's, if we're it, I'm sorry, I know there's some smart people out there, but that hurts me to know that, like, the smartest person on Earth is it. Mm-hmm. And we're in trouble.
You could also make an argument from human rights. Human rights does not fit with the theory of evolution or a godless universe.
That's a good point.
Where Tim Keller makes this argument in Reason for God, I think, that like if evolution is true and there's no God behind it and there's no God in the universe. This whole sense of human rights is, there's no such thing as human rights. It's just the survival of the fittest, the strongest. And in fact, you know, if grandma's slowing you down, you should knock her off so that the human race can move forward without grandma slowing you down. Versus, I would argue that within...
That can help with church conflict.
Yeah.
Yeah.
within everyone...
This person is slowing us down.
Yeah.
Within everyone, there's a sense. Every culture around the world, no matter if they have biblical revelation or not, has a sense of human rights, that you should protect the weak, not hurt them, that you should, that it's wrong to murder, that everyone has some sense of a right to life, and we should care for each other. You know, maybe it doesn't go all the way to, like, loving your neighbors, but there's a sense of we don't violently attack each other. This goes bad. Where does that come from? And theists would argue God has put it there. And that there is a God who has given us some sense of human rights imprinted on our soul points to a creator, versus if everyone had a sense of evolution within them that just the, you know, the strong rise to the top, leave the weak behind. And yet every culture has had some sense of human rights.
Well, if you look at Hitler and you are an evolutionist, how can you be upset with him?
Fits perfectly, yeah.
It fits perfectly.
Cut that quote out and post it somewhere.
How
can you be mad at Hitler?
That's going to be the title.
Hitler and evolutionist,
I'm tweeting that
right now. No, don't. Yeah. If you're an evolutionist, though, like, if you look at that, I mean, but the fact is people looked at Hitler and they're like, he was an evil man. Why was he an evil man? Right? Because
he killed those who slowed down the country, yeah.
Right, or ones he deemed not as worthy, or not
handicapped people, mentally ill.
Yeah, or just races he thought were lesser.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, yeah, the fact that exists doesn't fit in with the scientific evolution.
There's probably many more. This is just the ones I can think of at the top of my head. But a really good book, if you're wondering about this, I would say, is Tim Keller's book, The Reason for God.
Mm-hmm. Might be the best book I've ever read.
Yeah, so if you know, or even to give to friends, if they're going, how do we know that God exists? And he talks about the clues of God. And these things I'm talking about are ideas he would touch on with greater brilliance and accuracy. But
you mentioned another book by Tim Keller. That's The Reason for God. But didn't you say that argument? Oh, I thought.
Yeah, no, that's in Reason for God.
That's in Reason for God.
He talks about what are the clues. He spends like a couple chapters talking about the clues for God.
Yeah.
And one of the, you know, he talks about the fine-tuning argument. And these are common arguments that apologists and theists would make, like the fine-tuning argument, the argument from human rights. And these are things that don't prove definitively that God exists, but are good clues, which taken together, all these things taken together, you would say, makes it most likely, very probable, that there's a designer God.
Mm-hmm.
And then you combine that with, and this God has revealed himself in the scriptures. This God has spoken to us, you know. So I think it fits well. Mm-hmm. And then it, when you take it all together and think about it that way, the alternative that there is no designer behind anything, and especially cumulatively, all these arguments, you go, what are the chances that there's no designer behind it? Mm-hmm. No God who's revealed himself, no God who's designed and made it this way. It's all just by chance. And you go, now that's a faith system.
Yeah. Well, I think I've really come to the conclusion, like, you know, I've watched YouTube videos of, you know, the atheist trying to use his argument kind of to debunk Christianity or whatever. Like, you see this stuff all the time. But one of the things that I've really just come to wrestle with, like, in my own life, is like trying to think about how can we share the gospel with people. And especially if they're holding that position, is sometimes understanding that, belief in election helps, but sometimes recognizing that there's people who all of us have this desire to not be held accountable. And I think...
like Adam in the garden.
Yeah.
She may be...
Yeah. Bingo. Yeah. And I think... and Steve touched on it on Sunday, but I think a big part of that is that, like, it's easier to rationalize some of these things in our mind because the end result is, you know, if I say I am the supreme authority for my life, I make the decisions, that there is no higher power, there's no creator design, we are all cells in a moment of chance, then I can live my life however I choose, and I can value whatever I choose in the pursuit of my own hedonism. Mm-hmm. And really, I feel like atheism and in a lot of ways, agnostic belief systems are based on those principles at the heart and root of it. This individualistic, hedonistic, pursue my passion, my sin, without accountability. It's actually ignoring the reasonable faith that it takes to have.
It is amazing that so many atheists are so angry with God. He doesn't exist, and I'm mad at him for not existing. And, like, yeah. It feels like it's an emotional issue more than it is intellectual. Yeah. Like, I don't believe in the boogeyman, but I'm not committing my life to disproving him. I mean, I don't believe in the tooth fairy, but I'm not upset with the tooth fairy for not existing. It's not emotional.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most.
You're losing your teeth, right?
Yeah. Well, most atheists are actually. It's very emotional.
I have a childhood friend who's definitely a strong professed atheist, but she would. I don't say that she comes across so mad. I think there might be a harder matter. She's mad with God, but that wouldn't be how it's articulated. It would be she's mad at Christians, and her thing would be like she gets angry that Christians brainwash poor people that get brainwashed by Christians. And I'm like, but if you just go back to your argument on the self-serving center of, like, I don't want to be accountable, like, hedonism, whatever, I'm like, so what you want is what you really are saying. You don't like, what exactly are Christians getting brainwashed into that makes you so angry for the sake of the people getting brainwashed? Because I don't think you like the fact that you would be made to feel challenged on anything that you're wanting for yourself. You're doing it in the name of other people, but to protect the poor other people. Yeah. But I'm like, I don't think it's about other people.
It comes back down to a reaction against authority. Mm-hmm. And that even when they comment like that, I don't like people teaching or brainwashing. Brainwashing can only happen when there's an abuse of authority. You brainwash people who've entrusted themselves to you, right? Like, and you fill them with untruth and lies, essentially, to get them to do what you want them to do. That's what brainwashing really is.
But that's how she sees the church.
Yeah, yeah. But what I'm saying is that in order to do that, you have to have some sort of authority. And she's, in a roundabout way, to me, arguing, I don't want authority. I don't want to be brainwashed. I don't want to put myself in a position where I could be under authority. But also in the same time going like, I don't want that authority in my life. I don't want any authority. And I believe I haven't been brainwashed to believe what I believe.
But she would have no issue sharing her beliefs
right.
with authority to totally other people.
No, it's called teaching.
Yeah.
But when
yeah.
people teach something that I disagree with, I call it brainwashing, which is just a way of name calling. Instead of actually addressing the topic,
yeah.
You just resort to name calling.
They're like, brainwashing. How is she, you're teaching your belief. Professes what she believes so vehemently and strongly to a group of people, how would that
not
meet her own standards?
She would call it teaching.
Yeah.
See, when something you believe in is taught, it's called teaching, enlightening, helping people to understand. And when someone teaches something you disagree with, you call it brainwashing because you don't want to actually deal with the topic, subject matter. You just call names. Mm-hmm. They're brainwashing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, speaking of issue of people we know, we're going to go into one last question for today. And that was, when someone does me wrong, do I still love them and like treat them always like a best friend? So I think we're talking about the issue of forgiveness here, right? So if someone does something wrong to me, am I still required to love them and treat them as a best friend and go forward? So how do we deal with people who do us wrong?
Frozen yogurt. You have to always go for frozen yogurt.
What? That's not consolation. That's not. Yeah. Are you taking them for frozen yogurt?
Yeah, like if you don't love someone, that's the best way is froyo.
So if you take someone in our congregation now who's been listening to the podcast
for frozen yogurt, that means I don't like you.
Oh man, yeah. You are setting yourself
I'm
up.
I'm just kidding.
Okay, Steve,
kidding.
Can you ask me
a
question?
I'm just trying to make it really easy for Steve. I don't know why I said that. I just wanted to try and get froyo into a podcast. That's what it was. No, what kind of person eats frozen yogurt?
Don't even start. Okay, stop.
Ice cream.
Steve,
frozen yogurt is like ice cream without sugar.
No, it's not. You obviously not had good frozen yogurt.
No. I haven't because there's no
cheese. Okay, I'm going to get totally pulled down your rabbit trail here. don't pull me down. Okay, Steve. Question. What do we do when people wrong us? What is required of us as Christians? I think that's what the question is leading to.
I mean, I think we always want to live reconciled with people. We always want to seek restoration of relationships and forgiveness and mutual forgiveness where there's hurt. I think our goal always should be restoration of a relationship, whatever the relationship was, that you can get back to that place, that the hurt that was brought in by someone's sin or both people's sin can be forgiven, restored, and you can move back to that place.
That would be the ideal.
That's what we're trying to accomplish. And as a church, as a community group, we want to help the people in our group or help people get back as third party. Sometimes that's needed. You want to restore, whether it's marriage or friendship, whatever. You want to restore it back to where it was. And we believe that God is a God who restores broken things and that he can and often does do that. I guess that, I mean, so that's what we want to do. I think there might be times when you never quite get back there, but there's still forgiveness. I don't know. I think of, there may be hurt that is forgiven and yet trust will never get back to that same place, I think, or they're not necessarily the same thing is what I'm saying. You can forgive someone who's hurt you, but it may take time to build up to that place where I actually trust them with that same level.
What you're trying to say is that I think sometimes, I feel like what you're trying to say, sometimes under the auspices of forgiveness, people, especially the person who's been in the wrong. So I think about, like, if I've hurt my wife, for example, I want restoration. So if I confess that I made a mistake and ask for her forgiveness, she will give it to me. But sometimes she won't maybe forget right away. She might still be upset about it, but it doesn't mean that she's holding it against me. It might just mean that there's been some pain.
You have to work the trust back.
Yeah, and that, not thank God we haven't had a serious issue like that in our marriage. But like those things are natural. But I think what Steve is trying to point out is like at the end of the day, God actually wants us to turn and face. That's the way I always think about when it comes to conflict. Both in our relation to him, he wants us to turn and face. So repentance is us turning and facing him and recognizing our brokenness. And I think in relationship, it means turning and facing one another and trying to work through and restore the relationship. Whereas when we choose not to, often when we ask these types of questions, I think we're looking for a reason to run, a reason to not face conflict. And sometimes it's justified in that it takes two to heal a broken relationship often, right?
Yeah.
If one person wants to end a marriage and one person does not, it's really hard to make that work because it takes two to tangle. And the same is true for broken relationships. If one person wants to turn and face and the other person wants to turn and run, there's going to be this dog chasing the tail kind of situation as opposed to face-to-face mm-hmm. coming together. And,
could
there also be the situation of, like, I agree, like, as Christians, we want to be able to realize how much God has loved us, how much he's forgiven us, even when we don't deserve it. And, you know, who is it asked, how many times do I forgive? It's 70 times 7, yeah. Peter. Like, you know, and so, and that's a challenge. And we need to rely on God's help to do that. So mm-hmm. I would agree with, and the goal would be restoration.
Yeah.
But then there's the complication of, like, what if it's someone who's not looking for that? But the question was, like, if someone does me wrong, do I still have to love them and still always treat them as a best friend? I think there's also the question of healthy boundaries. Like, I'm not necessarily yeah. talking about marriages, but, like, healthy boundaries in some relationships yeah. where if you can love people and maybe there are still some relationships where you have to have healthy boundaries that aren't about hate. They're not about, you know, but yeah. they're not...
they're about wisdom.
They're yeah. about wisdom.
Like, if, yeah. you know, if I'm the treasurer of the church and I've been put into this position of leadership and I'm stealing money and I can come forward and repent and ask for forgiveness...
And there can be restoration.
And there can be forgiveness and restoration.
But you're not going to be treasurer.
You're probably not going to make me treasurer again. And that yeah. would be unwise because I've proven myself.
Not because we don't love you. It is actually because we love you.
Yeah, you want to
protect you from temptation
exactly.
again.
Yeah. Yeah. So but there's consequence, right? That's part of the equation.
The most hardened criminal can be forgiven by God, but that doesn't mean that you're going to put him in the nursery.
Yeah.
And in this question too, it doesn't say like, okay, when someone does me wrong, do I still have to love them? The person asking the question hasn't indicated have they apologized and want to make it right? Because sometimes it's like someone hurts me badly, they haven't repented, they haven't. I'm thinking of an example here: someone who's done something quite hurtful to me, has never repented, never apologized, never indicated that they've done wrong, just pretended it didn't happen. Am I obligated to love them? Yes, I'm supposed to love my neighbor. I'm supposed to love my enemies. Am I obligated to forgive them? Yes, I am. I am obligated to forgive them, even if they haven't sought forgiveness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But do I have to treat them like a best friend? I think where there's been hurt and no repentance, no desire to change, I can love them, forgive them, but I might not eagerly enter back into a situation where they can repeat that.
Where you're a doormat.
Yeah.
You know, like if you have a friend who keeps taking advantage and isn't good at, and can you love them? Can you pray for them? Can you forgive them? But does that mean that therefore, because I'm a Christian, I need to let them keep doing this with me?
When two parties want to reconcile, oh my goodness, yes, let's forgive, let's rebuild it, we can grow again. But if we're thinking of a one-way situation, do I have to love the person that's still abusing me? You have to love them, forgive them, don't be bitter and angry and hold against them and retaliate. But do you have to be best friends, continually putting yourself in a situation where you're going to get hurt more and more? I'm not sure. I don't think so. But so what I want to do is separate love and forgiveness with, like, it talks about being a best friend. It talks about, like, trust.
Yeah.
And no boundaries, sort of where it's like, just that sort of intimate level relationship where you trust someone so much that they have opportunity to hurt you. Do I need to continually allow myself to get hurt by the same person over and over again? No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
But
and
you
also
need to forgive.
Forgiveness and loving people is also for our sake as much as theirs. It's not just us being super gracious to them, but I really appreciate, like, on the great encounter night on Friday, Whitney was sharing on the topic of forgiveness. And I thought she had a couple really great illustrations, but one of being the prodigal son, that when the son returning was still a long way off, the father, you know, like, was already preparing and running to meet him for that restoration. But she talked about that quote, I don't remember who it was from, of, like, you know, bitterness is like taking poison and waiting for the other person to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really telling him, like, when, if there's any relationships in my life where I'm just so frustrated and bitter, but it's like me taking poison and waiting for it to affect the other person, you know, where I need to give that back over to God. That's where
what about
but that doesn't mean all of a sudden
adoption,
that was also good. That was okay, but we're not talking about adoption today. So we're not gonna talk
I mean,
about
I'd
it.
Say I'd say if somebody if there's two people and they both, like, if the person is apologizing to you and wants to reconcile and restore, Yes, do everything in your power to rebuild that relationship and make time for trust to be rebuilt. But two parties should really work hard to do that, and that would be the goal. If the question is, do I have to forgive and love and have trust that person who's still hurting me and is not repentant, not apologizing? So yes, you need to forgive them and love them, serve them, treat them well, not be bitter, not be angry, not retaliate. But you may need to put some boundaries in place for your good and theirs if they're continuing to continue in this sin or whatever hurt that there is. And you're not obligated to like constantly hang out with someone who's berating you all the time, for instance. Like, forgive them, but maybe you should find healthier relationships. And so depends on the situation, and these things are a little bit complex. Our goal is reconciliation, but it takes two people.
Yeah, and I think it's important to say, like, if you're in that situation where you're battling that, can talk to a pastor about how you might want to, or someone that you trust, like, get some outside counsel to walk through, because it's a different equation. If we're talking
about godly counsel.
Godly counsel,
because it's not godly, they might give you totally different advice of what you should do with that person. You
know, if it's your marriage, I would probably think about that answer very differently.
Yeah,
if it's,
that's true.
If it's a colleague or someone that you work with, like, because we would recognize that, you know, there are seasons in relationships in life with people. Like, I have, Steve and I would both say probably we have people that we were very good friends with in college that we have no ill will towards, but sometimes the seasons just change and you move on, and you move on to different groups of friends and different people, and sometimes it's a result of maybe being hurt and forgiving and then just saying, you know what, I'm going to move on from this chapter. But if it's, it depends on the context of the relationship, so it might be helpful to come and sit down in Steve's office or talk it through.
And there's a good point about marriage, because the difference is here are two people who before God and their church and their family have covenanted to be best friends. They have promised before God and everyone else.
There is no season.
So
it's all seasons.
So you've made that covenant means it's not just like some relationships, some, you know, your neighbors, you move, they come and go, but this is a relationship which it's worth extra effort to rebuild that, and don't give up easily on that. Keep working at that, get help.
Yeah.
Versus some relationships, someone hurts you and you may not see them as often and you forgive them. But so I mean, it's a little bit different, I'd say, for marriage, because you've covenanted together.
Yeah, and sometimes in those in those examples that aren't marriage, you know, I can think of people that have hurt me last year that I've forgiven and have distanced myself from, in a sense. But if I ran into today, I'd be happy to give a big hug to and say hello, and like, because I've moved on, in the sense of I've moved on from the frustration and the pain and the hurt, and that relational space helped that. But sometimes it doesn't help it. If you know, if I hate Rhoda because she did something to me, or I'm mad at her. We have strife. Sitting next to her in the podcast every week would be like torture. Well, more than an argument.
So we have to reconcile every time before we
start. Yeah, we always sit down, we pray together, we talk about how we're sorry. No, we're kidding.
It's always Tyler saying he's sorry.
No.
Okay.
I would never do that.
Okay, well, we're going to wrap it up for today.
Love you, honey.
But if you have more questions on any of the stuff, and again, just send them on in. We'd love to hear from you. We're glad to spend time with you. And thanks for joining us. Talk to you next week.
See you later. Yes, I do.